the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has a new image on the front of its website. It's Wisconsin teen Jamie Kloss with the words under her picture, "This is why we never lose hope." There's no reliable way to determine the total number of children who are missing in the U.S. And the good news is the odds of a missing child being found is much higher today than it was several decades ago. We're talking about resources for the families of missing loved ones and the communities they live in. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Allison Fay now. She's director of the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minneapolis. It aims to end all forms of child maltreatment through education, training, and prevention and advocacy for victims. Allison, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jacob Wetterling was abducted and murdered in 1989, and his mother, Patty Wetterling, has said that police know how to find a stolen car because it happens frequently, but child abduction cases are less common, but it's important we know what to do in the event they occur. What have we learned in the years since Jacob Wetterling was abducted?
I think the big push is just the collaboration piece being so important. You know, one of the things you could tell in the press conference with Jamie's case is all the different agencies that invested time, people, and resources. And the more people that we have involved and the more agencies that are working to help, you know, it's more bodies, it's more energy. Sometimes back a few decades ago, it was very siloed with, you know, this is our case and no one else is going to touch it. And we found that that's not as helpful as having, you know, reaching out to resources like, as you mentioned, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
And there were approximately 3,500 tips in the Jamie Kloss case. How important are tips?
Well, it's tricky because we want people to, you know, err on the side of calling. If they feel like when people have a big case of a missing person, it's kind of like a puzzle and they're looking for that one piece that will help break the case. In this case, it was Jamie who provided that piece. But you never know if your piece is that information. The other flip side of that is people so want to help and their hearts are so invested that sometimes the next person they see, they'll think is you know, the person of concern. So law enforcement, they'll spend a lot of their time eliminating tips as they work to try to get the right information to come in.
The work you do at the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center focuses a lot on child abuse and abduction prevention. So what should parents be doing right now? What conversations should they be having with their kids about safety?
First of all, we are all about prevention, and it's a big part of it. And I think it's right now, this, you know, if you read the complaint yesterday, if you heard about it on the news, the details are horrific. And that if you're not completely, you know, floored and upset by reading it, I would be concerned. But we have to remember that there are kids who are looking at this information as well, and it can be terrifying. So right now it's really important for parents to reassure kids that they're special, that they deserve to be safe, that if anyone, you know, ever does anything that might make them feel scared, to let you know. These cases get a lot of publicity because they are so rare, and that can skew things for kids who see this stuff on, you know, when they're watching TV or they hear it on the school bus, and it can be terrifying. So we need to remind kids, it's your job to be a kid. It's my job to keep you safe. And let's talk about our family safety plan.
What is the details of a family safety plan? What does that look like?
The best way to talk about safety, the two main questions to talk about with kids of all ages. We don't focus on do we know the person or not, because in over 90% of the time, abusers and those who are harming children are people the child knows. We also know that most people do want to help kids, but the good news is most people don't harm kids. So you don't want to scare kids from people who they don't know. Like in Jamie's case, it was someone she didn't know who she approached and who helped her. So the two questions that we teach, instead of focusing on how we know someone, is how do they make you feel? The first question is this person trying to get me to break my rules? And the second question is, how does this person make me feel in my stomach? You know, do they give me an uh-oh feeling? Give me that mixing bowl in my tummy feeling? If either of those questions are, you know, if you ask, is this person trying to get me to break my rules? Does this person give me that uh-oh feeling? You have every right to leave that person and go check in with someone else who takes care of you. And so when we established those two conversations, we then followed up with a lot of what ifs. You know, what if someone that we know and like is asking to break our family safety rules? And we can reinforce the kids in those moments. I wouldn't be mad at you. I would want to know. I would believe you. Some of the many reasons why kids don't come forward with an adult is something that scares them.
Talking with Allison Fay, she's child abuse and abduction prevention advocate, directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child? And what rules or strategies does your family follow? How are you handling the Jamie Claus situation for yourself personally and for your children? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Allison, what you said there for a moment about the gut feeling, what's in your stomach, it reminded me of a piece I read over the weekend about the Jamie Claus situation. And a mother was being interviewed with her child by her side, her 10-year-old, and the child suddenly doubled over and said, and this is in the reporting, said their stomach hurts so much they think they're getting sick. How is this impacting our kids?
I think adults have to do a better job of thinking about how the words that we say impact kids. You know, for me personally, just looking at online, the amount of victim blaming that adults engage in online, you know, I wonder if this person has anything to do with the, you know, what message does that give to our kids, you know, when they see that? We know in almost all cases of abuse and abduction, when the child knows. So most kids don't tell for a wide variety of reasons. And so to have those things being talked about by adults, you know, questioning the victim, blaming the victim, what does that say to the child who hasn't come forward yet? And I think we have to own doing a better job of making it a culture where kids are respected, where adults are held accountable for hurting kids without, without vilifying our kids. And I think we have to do, you know, we can't wait for our kids to come to us. We need to be having proactive, positive conversations with them so that they know that they always have that safety net of people that they can talk to about problems.
You work in classrooms helping kids to recognize danger, and they often have stereotypical ideas of what can cause harm. How does giving kids scenarios and examples help them process potential threats that may not be the stereotypical threat of a stranger in the bushes?
Well, we don't want it to be on the children's shoulder. You know, it's up to kids' job to be a kid. We don't want to put the whole responsibility for safety on their shoulders because it's not fair. And it's not effective. What we want to be doing instead is teaching them the basics of, like, checking first. Okay, we check first before we get in the car with anybody. We check first before we go into anybody's house. And then it's up to the adult to be, as they're checking first to see if this is something that they want to do. The main rule, abductions are so rare. We have about 115 in the United States every year. They're very rare. And so the big safety rule with that is we don't go anywhere with anyone who doesn't let us check first.
We're talking about resources and abduction with Allison Fay. She directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minnesota. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child recently? And what rules does your family follow? Are you an educator? How do you address safety in school? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What we know is that it's very rare for a stranger to abduct a child. The Missing Children Division for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children breaks down their numbers this way. They help law enforcement with almost 6,500 active missing children cases at any given time. And in the most recent year studied, only 115 kidnappings were cases of children taken by strangers or very slight acquaintances. We're talking resources for communities and families with Allison Fay. She's a child abuse and abduction prevention advocate, and she directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in law enforcement? What would you like adults to know when it comes to child abuse and abductions? What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Allison, when an abducted child is found, or in Jamie Kloss's case, it's the beginning of a long journey for them, what should communities keep in mind when a child is returned?
I think it's important to just keep in mind to let the child have some space. I've been so impressed with what I've seen coming out of there, and just with the positive energy and the people rallying together, and the fact that they held on to the hope in such a public way for so long, which is a wonderful thing. And now it's time to take a deep breath, like they are doing, and give Jamie space as she adjusts to, with professionals, adjust to whatever is to come in her journey.
So what is that healing process like, and what are some of the interventions that there will be along the way?
It's often child-led. I don't know if you saw the press conference, but the sheriff did mention that they already had a reunification plan in place, which is wonderful. When they're not trying to put together, counselors and resources at the last minute, but they planned for when she comes home, here's what we're going to do, here are the things we're going to offer. And a lot of it is letting, adjusting to the child and where the child is at. Every person is different. People have different needs. And just for Jamie, it's really about just having that space, that time. We learn from kids who were abducted and have been found what works and what hasn't worked. And the idea of even just celebrity can be so uncomfortable because you feel like you're sort of in a spotlight. And so creating that new sense of normalcy and surrounding her with support will be so important.
We've seen pictures of her with a beaming smile with her dog, Molly. What can we take away from those pictures?
I think the important thing is that she is in a place now where she has the ability to rebuild in whatever that looks like. A lot of people will say, oh, she's found, so now we're at the end of the story. And for Jamie, she's at the beginning of her story. And she gets to decide what her story looks like. It's not this person who took control for this period of time. That chapter's done, and now she gets to take control and write her own story, and we can support her in doing that by not having her feel like that she's in the spotlight and not having her feel like that she's having that public pressure. So hopefully as people now have the details and are able to understand what happened, there'll be sort of some relaxing of that public eye and to give her and her family the space that they need.
Teachers often talk about current events in their classes. What recommendations would you give to teachers in how they talk about this Jamie Kloss situation?
I guess the big piece is the reassurance. I mean, these cases are so rare. Yes, they sometimes do happen, and when they do happen, we are much better at finding children than we ever were before as a country, but I think the big message here is no one has the right to hurt kids. And if that's what we, here's the deal. No one has the right to hurt kids. If anyone is ever doing something that hurts you, your body, makes you feel scared, let's talk about who the five adults are in your life that you could tell. And we say five because sometimes it's the person on that list who's causing the problem. And we say five because sometimes it's the first person we tell doesn't help. But use this time to help kids identify who are the positive adults in their life, who are the healthy adults in their life, that they can reach out to if they need help. Because the good news is there are way more people out there who want to help kids than the very few who do harm them.
Let's go to the phones now with John joining us from Richland Center. Good morning, John.
Good morning. If it's possible, can you make a reconnection to your guest? It's difficult to hear from her.
Yeah, we have a difficulty, but I understand you work in law enforcement.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on the situation?
I think it's important for people around the abused child to listen to him when he's speaking out. I am a former inspector for La Crosse, and I prevented the drowning deaths of 8 young college students in less than 10 years. Because I did my job and I told them to put a guardrail up. Well, getting on to today, my mother died 2 months ago. Her last words to me were, John, they will never put me in prison for what I did to you. Nobody listened to me. They made me feel that I was to blame because I was talking bad about my mother. She tried to drown me in the bathtub.
John, I'm going to have to cut you short here, and it sounds like there is a lot you are working through. Allison, in terms of this situation that John is feeling right now, what would you say?
First of all, I'm sorry. What should not happen to you? What should not have happened to you? I think that's important for kids to have that safety net of more than one adult to tell, because sometimes the family isn't the safest person to watch the child. Sometimes the family is the problem. And so to know that there are other adults in their lives that they can reach out to if they need help is so important.
Allison, at this time when we see a very positive outcome for a family with a missing loved one, what happens to those other families who are still looking, for someone who has disappeared?
It reminds us that missing people do come home. You know, the National Center has over 5,000 cases where kids were gone for more than 6 months and still recovered. And so when you see those faces, when you see them coming through social media, you see them up in public buildings, to stop and look at those faces and know those faces, because it is knowing faces that helps bring kids home.
And there's also perhaps the chance where they reconnect with their center, with their resources, and say, is there something that happened in this case that isn't happening in ours?
Well, and I think we're always looking at these cases from a prevention lens. You know, I will be very interested in the months down the road to learn more about the offender and where were opportunities that we could have seen if there was a problem before it got to the point of him hurting children. In this case, it's not about what could the child have done to protect herself. That's not what it's about. She did everything right. The question is, what could we do to fail her? Where were those steps that could have, with this person who caused the harm, we could have had some intervention. And so I'll be interested to hear that down the road.
And finally, Allison, as communities look to address abduction and abuse in their own regions and their own cities and towns, what could communities do better, especially on the law enforcement side?
I think we are doing a better job. I mean, when Jacob was taken back in 1989, there were 60% recovery rate for finding missing people, and now the National Center says they're around a 97% recovery rate. So we're doing a good job. I think a lot of it, though, is the proactive, positive conversation. Teaching a child a safety rule, following up with some letters, and really talking about online safety in addition to personal safety, because that is a whole new layer that we see with our, especially with our 11 to 17-year-olds.
So online safety, 11 to 17-year-olds, what are the dangers you're seeing there emerging?
There's a wide variety, and the wonderful thing with Jamie's case is social media can be used for good. You know, it can be used to get her face on Facebook for people to know. The flip side of social media can also be used for bad. We talk about to pay attention to anyone who tries to isolate you from your safety net of people. people try to separate you from the people who love you online and in real life. You know, messages like, no one loves you but me, no one cares about you but me. That's a warning sign. And we see that isolation and we see that attention and affection really used on kids online quite a bit. So to remind kids, you know, that healthy people who want to be part of your life want to be one of many. They don't want to try to separate you from the people who love you.
Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Allison Fay is director of the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minneapolis. It aims to end all forms of child maltreatment through education, training, and prevention and advocacy for victims. Up next, it's news. And then a lack of pay for government workers could mean bad news for national security. We look at the relationship between financial insecurity and on-the-job performance and how it's playing out during the partial government shutdown. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.